shoulder takedown, shionage. There are endless variations, different ingredients and cooking times, if you like, which enable experimentation and growth in the student. One very able practitioner of Aikido only ever studied this one technique, and the discipline's founder, Morihei Ueshiba, famously wrote that the whole of Aikido was in shihonnage. Over the next few years, I refined the ideas I had picked up in Japan. I found Learning How to Learn by Idris Shah, Octagon Press, 1978, a particularly useful book in further developing the wider notions and implications of polymathy. Already, I saw that over-specializing in one subject was something of an illusory path. Viktor Frankl, in his 1946 classic of Survival in the Concentration Camps of Germany, Man's Search for Meaning, new edition, Rider, 2004, proved, as much as it is possible to do so, that man is not a pain-avoiding, pleasure-seeking android. Rather, he or she is primarily driven by meaning. He identified three areas which increase meaning in everyday life: caring for others, artistic, creative, or productive endeavor, and choosing one's own attitude to suffering and misfortune. The idea that life is about specializing leads to a diminution of meaning. The narrower your worldview, the more everything outside it looks meaningless. Only your narrow sliver of activity holds any value for you. You find you care less for other activities and the people who do those things. The less you create, make, and produce, the less meaningful the world will seem. If you suffer pain or loss, as we all must in our lives, mental flexibility, ideational fluency, in reframing and reconfiguring our situation can often mean the difference between life and death. The intimate connection between healthy mental and physical states is constantly being affirmed by new generations of researchers. A polymathic state of mind simply has more resources for dealing with life's blows than the singular, specialist mentality. Going for a Burton. I studied the lives of over 100 famous geniuses and polymaths. Two of them, Richard Francis Burton, the Victorian explorer, and Claude Shannon, the father of information theory, hold particular fascination for me. Burton could supposedly read and write in over 20 languages, and yet he had been sacked from university after just a year in which he spent most of his time bunking off with gypsies or other slack undergraduates. The exact offence that did for him was to drive a coach and horses through town on a day prescribed for such behaviour. He was an indifferent university student, but he changed when he joined the Indian Army, where he specialised in languages, studying for up to 11 hours a day, but always in bursts of 15 minutes, switching between areas within the same subject. It is common among polymaths to see such periods of intense and specialised interest as a key to learning. It is a kind of serial obsession, very different from multitasking, which has been shown to be less efficient. Burton took leave of the army and began exploring in the Middle East, where he entered Mecca in disguise, and Africa, where his account, Lake Regions of Central Africa, became a kind of guidebook for future explorers, including Livingstone and Stanley. Burton had many interests, many of which, exploration, translating, fencing, he performed at the highest level. He was judged to be one of Britain's finest swordsmen. He had, like Goethe and Leonardo before him, cracked one of the secrets of polymathy. Mastery, up to a point, is transferable. Juggling genius. Claude Shannon is the father of information theory, a veritable genius of early computer development who contributed to many areas of science. His master's thesis, A Symbolic Analysis of Relay and Switching Circuits, has been called by mathematician Howard Gardner possibly the most important and most famous master's thesis of the century. He then switched from electrical engineering to biology to write a PhD thesis on An Algebra for Theoretical Genetics. The polymathic Shannon was also a keen juggler, unicyclist, and chess player. He wrote the first chess-playing computer program and invented many things, both useful and humorous, including a motorized pogo stick and a rocket-powered flying disc. It was Shannon's interest in the micromastery of juggling that led to some very fruitful ideas, and also demonstrated that something apparently useless, juggling is mere entertainment to many, is actually a fascinating gateway skill, one that leads you from the tail to the body of the dog. The earliest depiction of juggling and wrestling is found in the comic-like figures on a wall in the Beni Hassan tombs in Upper Egypt overlooking the banks of the Nile near El Minya. These pictures date from 1994 to 1781 BC, nearly 4,000 years ago. Other cultures, such as the ancient Chinese, South American, and Indian, all practiced juggling through the ages. In Europe, it became a staple of fairs and travelling shows, often synonymous with jesting and trickery. Shannon was intrigued by juggling, partly because he found it difficult. He had small hands, but also because it provided a great insight into lots of problems involved in robotics. He went on to make the world's first bounce juggling machine. Bounce juggling is when you drop the ball and catch it after it bounces, rather than throw it upwards. He showed that if a machine can be taught to juggle, or designed to juggle, then it should be easy to make it into an efficient construction line robot. Shannon was also fascinated by unicycles. He often rode one along the corridors of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Riding the unicycle is, again, a classic instance of micromastery. Shannon had latched on to something humans find hard, and therefore fruitful for study. He took his interest a step further by making a robot unicycle. For this, he needed to invent balance systems far in advance of what was available, and his discoveries were able to benefit all kinds of robot manufacture. Here, a micromastery provided a distinct problem in a playful guise that could be solved for the benefit of all. I think that Shannon stumbled on an approach that scientists might well be able to use as a creative research tool. It was certainly used by another genius, Richard Feynman. Bored with physics after his PhD, he sat in the university cafeteria and idly watched someone spinning a plate on their finger. Spinning anything on the fingers is a classic micromastery. He watched the decorative design on the plate undergo a strange wobble and wondered if he could describe it mathematically. Suddenly, he was engaged. He was playing with maths because the situation wasn't serious. Feynman would later say that he made a decision then to have only a playful attitude to problems. Shannon, too, was famous for his playful approach and his crazy inventions, including the ultimate machine, where a box, when switched on, opened and a hand appeared and then switched off the machine before folding back into the box. Micromastery is essentially a playful activity. That's one of its great strengths. When Feynman finished playing with the maths of the plate, he found that it could actually be used to describe some knotty problems in subatomic physics. He opened up the whole field of quantum electrodynamics and went on to win a Nobel Prize. Creativity explosion. Simply growing up in the pre-modern period guaranteed a certain polymathic background. Making and repairing skills were not only common but also necessary for ordinary life. Having fun involved work and thought rather than deft handling of a remote control. The ease and comfort provided by modern transport, communications, and entertainment have stripped away this polymathic grounding, a world in which a butcher, a banker, or a miner's wife could also be a wonderful violinist and expert watercolorist. Even if such statements veer towards the sentimental and ideal, they can be an inspiration for those wanting to reclaim the potential promised by micromastery. I've always found it weird that it's only as we surge towards greater specialization and mechanization that we begin to talk about creativity and innovation. The great inventors of the past had no need to talk of brainstorming or lateral thinking. They did it naturally. People like Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell didn't need lessons in creative thinking because they already had such a diverse range of information and skills ready to deploy. It's interesting that the rise in creative thinking as a subject exactly parallels the disappearance of what gives rise to it, diversity of knowledge, information, and perspective. Micromastery and boosted creativity. Isn't the world crying out for more science graduates, more numerate specialists? Michael Brooks, curator of the Waterloo Global Science Initiative Learning 2013 Summit in Ontario, points out that theoretical physicists, technology managers, and even the CEO of Lockheed agree that more science graduates are not the answer. While it's true that low-level positions can be filled by numerate graduates, there is not a problem here and wages haven't risen in this area for good reason, the problem is higher up. The conventional specialized science graduate seems to lack organizational communication and management skills. So a gap opens up where the real creative work needs to be done. Brooks suggests a big change is required in the way people are recruited into university. They need smart, creative people with multiple micromasteries. Seeing resemblances and generalizing, learning from one thing and recognizing something a bit similar, this is how our mind navigates the world. The wider our base of knowledge, the greater our source of patterns and examples. How do we create new ideas? By cross-fertilizing old ones. Again, the wider our potential base of new ideas, the greater their variety and the more powerful our creativity. If you know about chicken and plastics, you may come up with the new idea of a plastic chicken drinker, a device for automatically dispensing drinking water to chickens, which made inventor John Leeming a millionaire in the 1960s. Or you might cross boarding school fiction with the idea of magic and come up with Harry Potter. Or take a skateboard, remove the wheels, and use it on snow. Or, if you have really diverse knowledge, you might end up using spider webs to make a new material stronger than Kevlar. The link here was that spider webs were also used as the crosshairs in telescopic sights, and Kevlar is used for bulletproof jackets. And it's not just inventors and writers who need innovation. We all do. Every job benefits from an innovative approach, and the bigger the pool of potential ideas you have, the better. Permission to be creative. Lorenzo Dominguez is an intriguing man. A corporate drone working in marketing in Manhattan, he found his life falling apart, with his marriage failing and the long commute in from New Jersey deadening. His wife had banished him to living in the basement under their suburban house, and Dominguez was at the end of his tether, though anxious to keep his marriage together for the sake of his two children. His wife suggested a trial separation, but living in a separate apartment was beyond his means. However, while sitting in a church in central Manhattan, he got talking to the priest, who was touched by his plight. He was given, rent-free, a small apartment right in the center of the city for 3 months before the property was redeveloped. Suddenly, with time on his hands, his commute was now a matter of minutes, he was able to rekindle his old interest in photography. Every night, armed with a fairly low-end digital camera, Dominguez took to the streets of New York to take street photos. Hundreds and hundreds of photos. Pretty soon, his Flickr feed was being followed by thousands of people, and his pictures were featured on over 200 blogs. Prestigious photo magazines wanted to use his cut-up photos and to interview him. He was a man in demand. So what was his secret? He gave himself permission to be creative. Street photography as a genre grew out of the photography of Henri Cartier-Bresson and various other Leica-wielding photographers in the 20th century. The Leica, small, easy to use, fast and discreet, was the ultimate tool for snapping candid shots in the street until the emergence of the high-end autofocus auto-exposure camera in the late 1980s and 90s. With motor-wind automatic, even more candid shots could be taken from the hip. The first digital cameras were clunky beasts, and remain so if you're talking about the top-end SLRs, but in 2005, the smaller, compact digital cameras started to be good enough to take creditable street photographs. Another leap in technique was now possible, except few took it, since most were stuck on their SLRs and still thinking largely in film terms. As street photography grew as a respected artistic subgenre of photography, it became encrusted with rules that were largely derived from film days, but which had become redundant with the rise of the digital compact. Dominguez just ignored all this. He saw his camera as a tool for creativity in the crazy dream world of New York City. He realized you could push a digital camera much further than film. For one thing, digital photography opened up greater possibilities of shooting at night. This was often a bit of a problem with film, as it required special developing techniques, but with digital, it's easy. Instead of doing what most street photographers do, trying to make pictures look like those of the masters of yesteryear, Dominguez went out looking for beautiful pictures anywhere he could find them, by twisting and tweaking his camera and developing software to the limit. Because you could take 600 pictures in an evening with a digital camera without breaking much of a sweat, you're in a different place from film, where you might manage 200. Gary Winogrand, one of the grand masters of street photography, used to shoot about 100 pictures a day every day, but he left behind thousands of undeveloped cassettes. The sheer processing time for developing and printing film means the photographer eventually holds back a little. And this was one of the gaps Dominguez exploited. He photographed sequences in the street rather than single shots, and his interest in the beautiful got him out of the usual dull clichés of street photography, the gritty or ironic shots in front of billboards. Dominguez micromastered photography almost by accident. Because he worked by day, he was limited to taking photographs at night. He had no money, so he used a cheap, compact camera that no professional would use. He was limited to his New York neighborhood, again, because of cost reasons. By narrowing it down to nighttime shots of New York taken with a cheap camera, he evolved his own unique aesthetic. With these limitations, he blew away many of the so-called professionals in the field. In reality, most street photographers make their living either teaching or taking more staid commercial photographs. He felt he had nothing to lose, and taking photographs was a form of therapy for him, calming his ruffled soul. We've seen before the link between play and micromastery. Because he wasn't a pro, he was able to play with the medium. He granted himself permission to play because it simply made him feel better. And it's a short step from having permission to play to giving oneself license to create, or even a mission to create. Lateral thinking, reverse thinking, brainstorming, and random linking. These are all the tried and tested ways to increase creativity. Lateral thinking is all about digging new holes rather than a deeper version of the hole you are already in. By thinking wide rather than deep, you make new connections, the heart of any increase in creativity. Random linking is similar. Just try to connect your current problem with something totally random, getting to the moon or bananas. Simply by forcing your thoughts in this contrived way, new insights tend to emerge. Reverse thinking is another way to generate new material by simply reversing any proposition or idea that seems staid or conventional or obvious. Brainstorming involves a group effort where the emphasis is on reducing naysaying and criticism until the session has ended. The process respects the fact that creativity is usually fatally damaged by criticism and self-censoring, based on our worries about what others think, far too soon. These techniques all evolved, it's reasonable to assert, as a response to the lack of natural material available to us, but readily available to our more polymathic forebears. Micromastery is like juicing. It simply supplies more concentrated raw materials than can be used in any of the above processes. But far more importantly, it gives you the confidence to switch perspectives. If you are a modern specialist, you are deeply scared of going outside your field, and you'll fight to the death almost anyone trying to trespass. This develops into a rigid mindset. You're in fight-or-flight mode, rather than open and sharing, which is how you have to be in order to be truly creative. So even if you pay lip service to the concepts of brainstorming or lateral thinking, they won't really work, because you'll be too darn scared to use them. But with a few micromasteries under your belt, enabling you to flip between widely different knowledge areas, facts can start to look different, and perspectives change, giving you the all-important confidence to be more creative. Switch to open. Once you get used to micromastery, you'll find that you're no longer seeing the world through half-shut eyes. You are slowly giving yourself permission to be interested in everything. You don't have to self-limit, and your interest won't be superficial. Michael Mersnick, already referred to several times throughout this book, is one of the world's leading experts in stroke recovery and learning. In his research into enhanced learning for stroke victims, he discovered that we have a kind of neurological switch which is either open to learning or not. Not surprisingly, dull and unengaging things leave us closed, but being closed can become a habit. In order to be open, we need to be familiar with the habit of focusing deeply and intently. Micromastery offers us this, giving us permission to be interested in anything we choose. But why wait? Let's look at some now. Micromastery Central. In this section, we detail 39 different micromasteries. Each has 4 to 6 instructional steps. But remember, these guides are just the start. Use the video resources of the internet for anything you want to focus on more deeply. I've chosen a pretty eclectic set, and these really are just the tip of the iceberg. But for this first excursion, I've focused on making and doing the things that seem to have caught my attention and held it longest. These are often traditional skills, albeit sometimes dressed up in a modern context. In some of the micromasteries, I've combined each instructional step with one of the six elements of micromastery: the entry trick, the rub pack barrier, background support, etc. In others, often those with fewer instructional steps, I've simply identified the various elements within the text. Either way, you have no more excuses. 1. Do a line sketch that looks creditable. Everyone can draw. No matter how terrible the humiliations at school, I guarantee you can draw. You may have heard it said that drawing isn't about drawing, it's about looking. This will become increasingly obvious. Usually, when people say they can't draw, they mean they can't reach into their imaginations and draw something realistic. But this is only one aspect of drawing, one you need never approach. 1. The way in is to copy another drawing, a line drawing you like. I found the sketches in Dan Price's offbeat books Radical Simplicity and The Moonlight Chronicles perfect for this. I also found copying sketches by the artist Egon Schiele easy and useful. But cast around until you can find some line drawing you like. I say line drawing because lines come first, even if arts teachers are always trying to get you using crayons and charcoal. These just produce mess, and what every would-be artist wants is something that looks like art and not mess. Experienced artists manage not to make messes even with charcoal, but we are not on that level yet. So, get a nice technical pen, one that is smooth and black and is appealing to hold, and get copying. 2. The rub-pat barrier for drawing is making something look both good and recognizable. The solution is to always err on the side of looking good. Doesn't matter if your drawing of a digger has wobbly lines, so long as it looks kind of cool. All that messy scratching to try and get the right line is something you should try later. For now, use other people's drawings, photos, and simple objects as an inspiration rather than a model. Decorate it with doodly bits, if that looks better. Exaggerate the good bits, miss out the stuff that looks boring. It's more enjoyable, and it looks better. 3. For drawing, you need a sketchbook that inspires. The more expensive, the better, I find. A5 is a good size for when you're out and about, but maybe an A3 for when you're at home. Whatever makes you want to draw. Pens follow this rule too. I find pencils boring and messy, but I use them for roughing out shapes. I prefer pens with very fine tips. 0.05 is a good size for me. I like Derwent pens and Birol pens. People will criticize you for using technical drawing equipment, but that's nonsense. Whatever makes you want to draw is good. 4. Tell yourself that you'll be happier when you have done a drawing, however basic. Artist and writer Shu Rayner showed me how he teaches the basics of drawing. Draw circles, squares, and cubes and tubes, and look for these in real life. See? You can already draw them. Drawing a nice picture of a sort of cube, maybe a table or a book, is very satisfying and easy. Sign and date it for extra motivation. 5. Drawing the same thing several times isn't that boring. I do cups and glasses all the time. After a while, I started to look more closely and even started the dreaded shading. It really worked. Then I looked at how the comic artist Joe Sacco shaded, and I tried to copy him. Another step forward. Unlike, say, photography, drawing allows an infinite number of variations in drawing the same object. 6. Experiment. The sky is the limit. Try that charcoal after all. Get messy. Branch out into watercolour, which you can ink over to get a nice effect. Copy pictures and drawings you like. I was told at school that copying was unoriginal. What nonsense. Copying is how you get started. Get confident and get going. After a while, you find your own preferred style. 2. Do an Eskimo roll. The one technique that signifies complete comfort in the water while kayaking is being competent at rolling when your boat capsizes. You're paddling along, sitting in the cockpit of your kayak, a spray deck around your waist to stop water entering the boat. Suddenly a rogue wave tips you over. Now you are inverted, head underwater, paddle in hand. If you manage to get enough traction with the paddle against the water, you can roll back up and revert to being on top of, rather than under, the surface. Many people learn how to roll only after they have done a great deal of paddling. But actually, as a classic micromastery, you can learn it even before you start using a kayak in earnest. The Eskimo roll was believed to be impossible for Europeans to master, an interesting inversion of the usual nonsense about racial inferiority. So it wasn't until the Arctic expeditions of Geno Watkins in the 1930s that learning how to roll a canoe was seen as a standard skill to acquire. It pays dividends to bear in mind the way Arctic dwellers originally rolled. They had a smallish paddle, they wore an anorak that didn't let water in anywhere, not even into their ears, and they never paddled alone, because you never know what might happen. Geno Watkins sadly ignored this last precaution and lost his life when he became too tired and cold to roll to safety. So, on that cautionary note, let's begin. First off, a capsize is when your kayak inverts and, as we have mentioned, you find yourself upright underneath it with water kept out of the boat by a spray deck around your waist. You allow your paddle to float alongside the kayak and, using it as a lever, pull on it to flip the boat over. By leaning forward along the front deck, you create less resistance to rolling up. Experienced rollers can roll using a life jacket or even by slapping the water with their hands. But for now, we'll use a paddle. The trick is in the hips. At first, you'll think it is all about the paddle, but, as just stated, people roll using their hands, so the power must come from elsewhere. It does. You're upside down, and your hips and backside, which are your body's center of gravity, are high up, almost above the waterline. Your thighs, feet and knees are braced against the canoe either directly or through straps, which allows direct transmission of a hip flick into the shell of the boat. Think of swinging a hula hoop around your hips. Now imagine flipping that hoop up in the air with one hip. With that image in mind, get to a dock or jetty or pool that has an edge you can grab hold of and capsize the body of the boat while you remain above water, hanging onto the edge. You are now in a position to use your hips to flip the boat upright. You will learn to feel the full connection from hip movement to boat. At first, you'll be heaving on the dock edge, but after a while, only the lightest of touches will be needed. You are now ready to try with a life jacket or swimming float instead of the dock. It's floating, so it's a little different, but the essence is the same. After the life jacket, move on to the paddle. You let it lie alongside the boat on the surface and pull hard down on it, initiating a stroke downwards. You're pulling on the paddle, so it won't move that far through the water. Remember, you are using it like a bar to help right the boat. The harder and faster you slap the water with it, the more it will act as if it is hitting something solid rather than liquid. At the exact same time, use a sudden hip movement to rock the boat the same way as the paddle pull-down suggests. You'll surge to the surface. 2. The rub pat barrier is matching the hip swing with the paddle pull-slap. The smarter the coordination of the two, the less force you need in either. You need to work on the dockside to feel the real connection between the hips, the boat, and the pulled-on object, be it hands, life jacket, dock, or paddle. If you neglect this and simply roll again and again, you can spend weeks with only limited success, whereas starting the way I've suggested can have you rolling in half an hour. 3. Get the gear that suits you, makes you feel like doing rolls. A small kayak is less important than one you fit well, with no slack between flexing your body and moving the boat. Wear earplugs. Constantly going under will ram water into your ears in a most unpleasant way. The original rollers wore an anorak over their heads, which you can replicate with a wetsuit helmet. Wear a wetsuit or dry suit, or do it on a very warm day. Getting cold will really damage your learning curve. Plenty of time to roll in icy water when you've mastered the technique. Wear a helmet in case of underwater obstructions. The paddle I favour is unfeathered and quite small. This means both blades are in the same plane while on the water's surface, providing a little more to pull off. But you may find feathered blades are better. 4. Fear of going over and staying under is the biggest worry facing a kayaker, whether on a rapid flowing river or in the sea or crossing a big windy lake. If you can't roll, you'll always be a little nervous. And if you're attempting very turbulent water, just knowing how to roll will improve your paddling skills no end. 5. To gamify learning to roll, you can make it a party piece whenever you go out kayaking. As long as you have your earplugs in, another plug for Doc's Pro Plugs, you'll be fine. 6. After micromastering a roll with a conventional double paddle, try with a single paddle. Then try with your hands. Try with a fully laden kayak. Try with a two-person kayak. The next step is to try to roll an open canoe with buoyancy in it. 3. Find the depth of a well or a deep hole. Everyone likes a good, deep, mysterious hole in the ground. It could be an old mine shaft, a cave, a well, or even a lift shaft, though you have to be careful dropping stones down lift shafts. Yes, stones. That is the secret of finding just how deep that hole is. 1. The trick is knowing the formula, a very simple one that dates back to Galileo. It relies on the fact that all objects, whatever their size, accelerate towards the Earth at the same rate, 9.8 meters per second per second. Speed is measured in meters per second, acceleration in the increase in speed, hence meters per second per second. Gravity is the cause of the acceleration, and as long as you don't choose a feather or a very light stone, you'll get a good result. A feather does drop at the same rate as a stone if there is no air, but air resistance is minimal on a small, heavy stone. Now, 9.8 is a bit clumsy, so let's round it up to 10. Next, you'll need a watch or a way of counting off seconds. I say 1 barabara, 2 barabara, 3 barabara, and it's pretty accurate. Accurate enough to get a well's depth to the nearest few meters. So, you release the stone and start counting, and only stop when you hear the plop. The depth is half of the acceleration, which is half 10, which is 5, multiplied by the time squared. So, if you time a 3-second drop, it's 5 times 3 times 3, which equals 45 meters deep. 2. Is there a barrier to doing this? Not really. Getting the timing accurate is the main thing. You can use a stopwatch if you like. 3. A good stone is hard to find. Well, maybe not that hard, but it's worth getting one. Sometimes holes and caves have updrafts and a tiny stone will catch in the wind. A massive great boulder is a tad over the top and might hit the walls of the well, which would mess with the time. A stone a little bit smaller than a golf ball will work fine. 4. The payoff for stone dropping is the intense satisfaction gained from knowing the exact depth of a deep crevice, hole, or puncture in the Earth's surface. It's in our nature to want to explore and know things we perhaps should not, and there is something a little miraculous in the idle and even careless gesture of dropping a stone down a well, resulting in a precise measure of its depth. Something only otherwise to be discovered by the painstaking and tedious process of lowering a weight on a measuring line. 5. To gamify stone dropping, make it competitive. You'll need a length of string that you pre-measure and lower with a weight attached into the well or hole. In other cases, you may find that the depth of the well is already known, the person who gets the closest to the official figure being the winner. Obviously, you have to exercise a bit of caution and common sense. A stone dropped on the head of a caver or someone down a hole can kill or maim, so make sure the hole is clear before you do it. 6. This is one of the most basic experiments in physics, but it leads into the whole realm of measuring things that perplex us on country walks and other excursions, when someone might ask, "How wide is that river?" or "How high is that tree?" followed sometimes by the offer of a wager. Well, Heights and widths are just as easy to compute from rudimentary tools and simple geometry, something that the practical amateur physicist might like to pursue, having tasted success in well-depth measuring. 4. Chop through a log, or even a tree. We live in ecologically minded times, thank goodness. But even so, there comes a time when some trees need to be felled, either because of old age or disease, or simply because there are too many of them. You could use a chainsaw, boo, which is a bit boring and ordinary, or you could use a felling axe, which isn't as straightforward as it looks. 1. Let's start with the log, lying on the ground, probably too heavy to move. Now, how do you cut through it? What usually happens is that the novice lumberjack hacks into it with carefree and ebullient abandon, only to discover that once he has cut a small V, he has to spend much of his energy widening the gap so that he can go deeper. This is time-consuming and makes it almost impossible to cut through a log much wider than a foot, 30 centimetres. However, the trick is to mark out a section as wide as the log is deep. You make a chop on the right, and then one on the left, and then prise out the chip of wood in between. If it's a 2-foot-wide tree, then the chip will be 2 feet long. You then repeat, making cuts to the right and left that are a little closer. Again, the chip comes flying out. It's very satisfying to see so much wood going with so little work, and it explains how the lumberjacks of yore used to deforest the planet so easily. 2. The rub-pat barrier is not that high once you have a good axe, and provided the wood isn't too hard. The main balance is between force on the axe and letting the weight of the axe do the work. If you wail on the axe, you'll tire very quickly. Anyone watching wood chopping done by traditional tribeswomen in the Himalayas will see the almost boneless way they chop, using their strength to raise the machete or axe and letting it cut using just its own weight plus a bit of accelerating whip. Getting a feel for an axe is about letting the 2+ pounds of weight in the head do the cutting, not your straining arms. Always look where you want the axe to land. Simply focusing hard on a specific spot on the log will be enough for you to hit the right spot. 3. The axe you need is for cutting and not splitting. As most people only use an axe for splitting, the wide, wedge-shaped head axes are very common, but aren't much use for cutting into a log or tree. To cut deeply into the wood, you need a narrow head, just as a filleting knife is narrow. How big an axe depends on what size logs you want to cut through. If you're going for felling trees more than a foot across, you'll need a full-size axe like the Grandsforge American felling axe, which weighs in at nearly 5 pounds, more than enough to chop through any log you want. 4. Chopping through a log is very satisfying. And when done correctly, the chips you prise out can be used as kindling, so nothing is wasted. You can then split the log using a wedge or a splitting axe, thus having a whole firewood-generating operation without recourse to the dreaded chainsaw. You'll also get a terrific workout, which develops strength and coordination. 5. If you have a wood-burning stove or a fireplace, it's very easy to use an axe instead of a saw. The ritual of sharpening and caring for the axe, which is much easier than it is with a saw, makes a further enticement for continuing to practice and improve. 6. Experimenting with an axe sounds a bit dangerous, but the axe is the preferred tool of many outdoorsmen like Ray Mears and Moors Kohansky. A smaller axe can be used for carving and even whittling, while a larger axe can be used to fell enough logs to make a shelter or even a cabin. The traditional pointed ends of a cabin's logs mimic those chopped by an axe rather than sawn through. 5. Learn how to climb a rope. Rope climbing is not often called upon except in the obscure world of the tree climber and tree surgeon. Mountaineers mostly don't know how to climb ropes. They use special ascending devices instead. In the gym, there is sometimes a thick, rough rope to climb, and some might manage it. For others, even this relatively simple ascent is as mysterious and difficult as the Indian rope trick. And yet, rope climbing is a useful combination of coordination and strength. It may even save your life if you find yourself trapped in some dark recess where only a rope's length can save you. And there is never enough time to knot the rope like in a children's adventure novel. It might be a case of climb or die. 1. Thick ropes are easier to climb as the friction between rope and feet, the key trick, is greater. A thin rope, typically found in tree surgery type climbing, is around 30 millimeters, half an inch, and not great for hanging from. A gripper knot or ascender device can be slid up the rope and hung off as you move your feet up. Either way, the key is in the feet, not the hands. As mentioned in dynamic learning, you have to wrap the rope around both feet in an S shape, the top foot in the top part of the S, pressing down hard on the other foot, the lower part of the S. Boots or sturdy trainers work better than bare feet with thin ropes. Thicker ropes allow thinner footwear and need less wraparound. The idea of looping the rope around the foot is to create a very powerful brake, which moves up the rope when the braking top foot is off, but remains locked on the rope when the braking foot is on. You hang by your hands for the brief moment that you slide your feet up the rope. Knees now bent, you apply the brake and stand up, straightening your knees and gaining height. The hands and arms are for hanging off only, not for gaining height. That's done by the knees straightening. 2. The rub-pat barrier is one of coordination. You have to hang for a second or two from your hands while your feet entwine the rope and slide upwards. You then tighten the coil of rope between your feet to lock yourself in position. This allows you to slide your hands up the rope to repeat the process. Sliding up and locking out efficiently greatly reduces the strain on the hands. Really, tree climbing is about coordination and skill rather than brute strength. Allowing the rope to travel round your feet without it coming off is part of the skill. 3. Start with a thick rope and progress to thinner ropes. If you aim to use the 13mm tree climbing rope, practice by hanging from an ascender and using your feet to slide up and down so that you get the hang of it. 4. Rope climbing is a great all-body workout. Though modern gyms may lack the old ropes dangling from the ceiling, there has been something of a revival of rope climbing as it is a favourite of military training. Because it builds upper body strength as well as calf and foot muscle strength and coordination, it's a unique exercise. 5. You can time yourself going up the rope. Indeed, if you get good, there are rope climbing contests you can enter. At first, you might fear that you'll run out of strength, but after some practice, this idea seems absurd. With the right technique, rope climbing requires much less energy than it seems to. At that point, you can start loading yourself with weights or tree climbing gear to make it harder. 6. Tree climbing has its dangers. I fell out of a tree once and broke my arm. But pursued carefully and with the right gear and climbing partners, you should be able to find a safety margin that works for you. Rope climbing might lead you into the heady world of climbing giant trees, over 300 feet, 100 meters tall in the US and Australia. This opens up a whole new world seen from on high. 6. Surf standing up. Surfing is the activity that signifies existential freedom more than any other. You're out there, in the moment, riding the wave and living the life. Never mind that in a few moments your nose will be dragging along the seabed as the board gets tossed by a giant breaker. For a few brief moments, you were up there with the gods. If you think you're too old to take it up, check out the book Surf Mama by Wilma Johnson, Beautiful Books, 2011, or Google Pensioner Surfers. 1. The entry trick, before you get out into the water, is to practice popping up onto your feet and not your knees. Using knees develops into a bad habit that is hard to break, and it isn't any easier to get up either. Start by lying face down on the ground without a board. Think of yourself as in press-up position, but it helps to have your feet flat out at the back as if flippering, not with toes curled under and gripping the floor. Do a rubbish press-up with your tummy still on the ground and keep looking ahead. Really arch your back before popping up and standing with your front foot under your shoulder. Don't worry about your flippered-out toes. They will obey the will to stand. Angle your body to face either right or left, but keep your head facing forward. The feet should be at around 45 degrees or so on the board. The main thing is to be in a balanced pose. When popping up, keep looking forward and not down, as head movement will upset your balance. Once you've begun to teach your body the move, transfer to a bouncy bed. Lay a surfboard on top, dangle your toes off the end, place your hands flat, arch up, and pop into position. The bed will wobble and simulate the water better than doing it on hard ground. When popping up feels natural-ish, get out into the waves. 2. The rub-pat barrier is synchronizing the upward push with the movement of the board on the wave. Too soon and you'll have no stability. Too late and you'll have lost control of the board. The moment when the board begins to slip away and you feel the force of the wave surge you forward is a forgiving moment. You can push into the board, and this causes further sliding down the wave rather than a wobble. Using this moment of stability makes it easier to get your feet on the board. 3. Get earplugs, Docs Pro Plugs, of course. Wear a wetsuit, a full-length one, if you have the slightest problem with cold water. The whole point is to enjoy being out there and not be shivering and desperate. If you're happy in the water, you'll find you spend less time in it. Get a board that is fairly long. Cool boards are really short, but the longer boards are more stable and easier to stand up on. Foam boards, also looked down on, are actually brilliant for starting on. Lastly, go where there are good waves breaking some way offshore. Learning in tricky waves makes it just that much more difficult. Going on a course after you've practiced popping up will give you great confidence, as the instructors will know the good spots for beginners to surf. 4. Surfing is a great way to visit some of the more remote spots in the world. From Norway to Angola, there are people searching out wilderness beaches to surf and enjoy. Surfing puts you right in the moment. It's a great antidote to routine and dull office life. Even if you're only in the water for a few minutes, it seems a much longer time. And then, if you're in for hours, the time can just fly by. 5. Surfing is addictive. Feed the addiction by finding some surfing pals. Be happy going in for a short time, coming out for a coffee from a flask, and going back in again. No need to be macho and keep going when it isn't fun anymore. Go for longer and longer bursts. 6. Surfing developed in Hawaii with two versions, stand-up paddleboarding and full-body surfing. Stand-up paddleboarding is one way to get into surfing without knowing how to pop up. On a paddleboard, you can surf even tiny waves and get used to standing on a board in water. You can also practice popping up on a paddleboard in still water. Better than practicing on land, as it's more realistic. 7. Talk for 15 minutes about any subject. Public speaking, famously more feared than death itself, is without doubt a key skill in most jobs. To be able to speak on any subject without preparation seems impossible to the uninitiated, and yet, as soon as you have read the following instructions, you too will be able to manage it. As micromasteries go, this is one of my favourites, and we have the inventor of most modern improvisation games, Keith Johnston, to thank for it. Keith Johnston, Impro, Improvisation and the Theatre, Methuen and Drama, 2007. 1. The main trick is to describe what you are doing, what you are feeling, what you are thinking right now. So if you are standing there feeling nervous and unprepared, tell the audience you are nervous and unprepared. If you have been given the subject of Chinese vases of the later Han Dynasty, tell them the precise limits of your knowledge, how little or how much you know, what the subject brings to mind or makes you feel. This is not simply waffling. It is the precise relating of your state of mind, and as such is perfectly germane to the subject. If people start shuffling their feet and leaving, tell the audience that too. Always good for a few laughs. 2. When you feel stuck for words, ask the audience. There is almost certainly someone or even several people who know more than you do about this difficult subject you've been tasked with talking about. Ask with enthusiasm and treat the volunteers with great respect and courtesy. Ask their names and occupations and where they live. We all love a bit of biography. Get them to come down to the front and reassure them. Then question them carefully to elicit what they know. after they are done, instigate a heartfelt round of applause. Avoid, like the plague, the easy and sarcastic comment. These folk just saved your bacon. 3. You are now into the final straight, and the third life-saving trick is to reverse the emotion. Rumble up to the revelation that Chinese vases actually make you sick, that they are pointless and useless, symbols of degenerate and anti-democratic practices, and so on. Reversing the emotion can bring out a whole lot of new and unsuspected material. 4. Being fearless at public speaking is a wonderful thing. Think of all those parties, dinners, weddings, business presentations, sales meetings, illustrated talks and Oscar acceptance speeches that will no longer fill you with fear. You'll find that people will actually laugh at even half-amusing things you say. Simply by being relaxed and using the audience, rather than feverishly trying to remember stuff, you will seem funny to them. 5. Practice whenever you can. You can do it down the pub or at a party. People might find it a bit odd, but this is the way to build even more confidence and humour, which is often a key part of a successful speech. 6. Public speaking might lead you into the incredible world of impro. This is far more than the type of thing you see on Whose Line Is It Anyway? Impro is about making your fellow improvisers look good rather than showing off yourself. When everyone is making everyone look good, all sorts of magic can happen. 8. Lay a brick wall. One thing that sets the dabblers apart from the more dedicated home improver is the ability to lay bricks. I mean, how hard can it be? Well, many try and fail, but there really is no reason. The idea that you have to be apprenticed at 15 to learn the dark art of bricklaying is nonsense. The celebrated polymath Winston Churchill was inordinately proud of the still-standing wall he built at his country retreat, Chartwell, so take inspiration from his example and get laying. Like all micromasteries, this could lead on to far bigger and grander projects, but everything starts with the simple laying of one brick on top of another to make, at its most basic, a wall half a brick wide, i.e. bricks laid lengthways, one brick in thickness. This is the best thing to start with, rather than the usual test piece, a barbecue stand, as the work is not complicated by adding slabs and grills. 1. The entry trick, the thing that will get you up and running, is the cement you use. Notice I said cement and not mortar. Lime mortar is a wonderful bonding agent that allows the building to breathe and even move a little, but it dries more slowly, while appearing to dry out faster, and is trickier to use. It's the next level up, perfectly attainable once you have mastered using cement, sand, and the all-important plasticizer. To be really certain, start with plasticizer, bought from a DIY store. Though dishwashing liquid is often used instead, proper plasticizer is much better and more durable. Mix up the sand, must be bricklayer's soft sand, as it has some clay in it, in 4 parts to 1 part cement. Then add the plasticizer, following the instructions. Do this in a bucket, easier at first than on a traditional board. Then add water, bit by bit, stirring with your trowel. You want to really break a sweat to get a soft ice cream or smooth peanut butter texture. 2. Work up to this slowly. The mix is the key. This is the rub-pat barrier. Too sloppy and the bricks will sink and misalign under the weight of the bricks above, but too stiff and the bricks won't adhere and everything will be dry and crumbly, and it's much harder work to get them level in stiff cement. When using the bucket and adding water, don't make too much. It's better to get the consistency right. Cement in a bucket won't dry out as fast as cement on a board, but you can always spray water on the top to keep it moist. And on a hot day, you can wet the bricks before laying them. All this keeps the mix in the right state. Now, slop some cement out onto the concrete base. Always have a flat concrete surface to build on, and notch a running V down the centre of the splodge of cement. How big a splodge? A good trowelful. The aim is to get the brick sitting on about 1/2 inch, 1 centimetre, of level cement, which means the initial lump of mix with its V should be about double that in thickness. You can angle the sides in a bit too, so that it doesn't splurge out too much. With the brick on it, it should not sink until pushed and tapped down with the trowel. Use a spirit level to make sure it is perfectly square, and use a notched measuring stick to make sure it is the right height. 3. Tools and materials are crucial to making it all work. Plasticizer and brick sand will really help with the mix. Get a proper bricklayer's trowel, not one of those little DIY tile trowels. Use a string line running the whole length of the wall to get a constant idea of the height the course of brickwork should be. For a first attempt, it is somewhat easier to build between two existing dead straight supports or walls. Filling the gap means you only have to worry about the lean of the wall and whether it is level. 4. Winston Churchill was so proud of his wall, he'd show it off to all visitors who came to Chartwell. People are impressed by anyone who can build a wall, even a low one, and this favourable attention should spur you on. But more than this, there is the almost primitive sense of achievement in raising walls. You are engaged in building the basics of a shelter, one of humankind's most fundamental needs. Perhaps some of that ancestral imprinting makes wall-making so addictive. 5. Just making one wall allows for great repetition of the basic act of laying a brick. You can focus on making each laid brick a perfect one. If it isn't, no matter. In a few seconds, you'll have yet another chance to improve your skills. 6. There is no end to the experimental possibilities. From the classic simple stretcher bond of bricks laid on top of each other in a single thickness, each one overlapping by half a brick, you can progress to all manner of fancy decorative styles of bricklaying. There are all manner of different, even coloured mortars. You could even build a house. 9. Write dialogue. Everyone is a writer these days. The mass use of computers and the internet in almost every home makes us all potential authors. Whether we're any good or not is almost irrelevant. The fact is, if you want to write and publish a novel or script, you can. And some novels by outsider authors, like 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James, can become huge successes. Every novel and screenplay needs dialogue. And this is where people demonstrate their skill in naked glory or ignominy. Even some rather well-regarded writers think dialogue is about conflict or Pinter-style parallel monologues, but there's much more to it than that. 1. The incredible entry trick of writing dialogue is status. Dialogue that is dramatically interesting reveals status difference. Perhaps we are attuned to this for evolutionary reasons. This doesn't mean higher status is good, it just means an attunement to status better enables one to survive. So, to write great dialogue, first assign status levels to both the interlocutors. This is not social status, but rather human interactive status. For example, Hugh Grant may talk like an upper-class Englishman, but he acts low status, hence the way he has problems with anyone more assertive than he is. A motor mechanic who is physically imposing and unwilling to play second fiddle to anyone will have higher status in a conversation than an aristocrat dropping off his Audi for a once-over. So before you start writing any dialogue, ask who is the higher status individual in this time and place. You might think they are equal status. In that case, do status switching. One acts high status for a while and then is toppled, maybe by a joke, and then the other gets the high status position. Friends signify their intimacy by treating status as a joke or by switching status for comic effect. One sign of high status play is the absence of a sense of humour during a status challenge. A high status player will fight rather than relinquish his or her status, which is where the drama comes in. 2. It's important to remember this. High status people can be happy and positive or mean and negative, and likewise for mid- and low-status people. We often assume that high status means gloomy and curt, the clichéd view of the upper classes in lots of movies, but a high-spirited and happy high-status person is also possible. The rub-pat barrier is balancing realism of dialogue, which is made easier once you have status involved, with meaningful content. Sometimes you have to show people talking nonsense. That's fine, but eventually the dialogue will have to convey meaningful content. Doing this without being heavy-handed is the balancing act, again made far easier by framing it as a status interaction rather than an information download. 3. Don't think character, think relationship when you're writing dialogue. That's where precept relationships come in handy. Mother-son, servant-master, teacher-pupil. A relationship is what interests us, not a bizarre character. A psycho serial killer with all his grotesque rituals will hold our attention for about 5 minutes.